Thank you for tuning into the VF1 show with VF and Vincenzo, the podcast that discusses all things business, marketing, politics, and government within the world of Formula One. If that's your thing, then you found the right place. So without further ado, it's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to the VF1 show. I'm Vincenzo, my co-host, VF, in the house as well. We have a very, very full slate today, and that's because it is testing week in Bahrain. We have cars on the track starting, well, it actually, if you're listening to this episode, it started yesterday. We're in the middle of testing right now while you're listening to this episode, and we'll have some more testing tomorrow. So freaking exciting. Not only do we have the testing, but for you Drive to Survive fans, Drive to Survive drops today, which if you haven't watched it yet, run to your Netflix, fire it up, and start watching season five. Does season five we're in? Yeah, season five. We're going to talk a little bit about Christian Horner. And we have a question that came in about nepotism in F1. We're going to talk a little bit about that. FIA super licenses. We're going to talk a little bit about testing. And what we have to bring up, Drive to Survive. That's what's on the slate today for the show. I want to see how you are doing first. V, what's up?
Oh, you know, just another end of winter-ish in Austin, where it's last week we all had our heaters on and this week it's like 85, our ACs are full blast, we're in summer mode, but then we're like, technically it's still winter, so we still want it to be winter. But I'm mainly just excited that the season's kicking off. I have had the biggest smile on my face all week and I'm ready for it. I just think that this is going to be one of those. I have a feeling this is going to be a really, really good season. So, I mean, I think we say that every season, but I'm just happy this week. What about you? How are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, doing fantastic. It is one of those, like you said, weather-wise, right? It's like it's so up and down here in New England. It's like the other day was 60 degrees and this morning was 25. There was ice on the road. I get up every morning at 4 a.m. and I work out at 5. I went to my gym. The road was pretty much a sheet of ice. And I was like, what? It was 60 degrees the other day.
Yeah.
Just wild. So other than that, it is what it is. But like you said, it is one of those weeks where you are like ready. And I'm ready. I'm ready for the season. When last season ended, I was actually really happy for the season to be over. I was like, okay, I'm done. I'm glad that we get a little bit of a break. But now I'm really yearning to see some cars on tracks and get some real racing back, because something about those, you know, livery car reveals and all the hype that gets, you know, flowing again, just gets the juices pumping, and all the news that's coming out, and there's sponsorship news, and there's new helmets dropping, and guys are partnering with new brands, and all these awesome things are happening, right? And you see all your friends that are, you know, headed down to testing or headed to do some project with a team, and you're like, oh man, it's back. Like, we are back in full swing. So it's that week where I'm ready for it. Don't really care too much about Drive to Survive in terms of like excitement. I mean, I obviously watched the season. I watch the racing, so it is what it is. I am excited to see how Netflix decides or how Box to Box Films decides to edit this season, last season. That'll be exciting, but yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for Friday. Thursday, technically.
It's so weird. We record on Wednesdays. We publish on VF1 Fridays. Yeah. But then it's like we're talking from the past about the future in today's episode. So it's like,
yeah, it's always the craziest thing.
Yeah, we're trying to put ourselves in the listener's perspective in terms of like, what are you guys going to want to listen to on Friday? And that's going to be a challenge with this broadcast, with this show today, but we're on it. We're going to do our best.
We got it.
Yeah, if there's any outdated material by the time we publish this on Friday.
Such is life,
then, you know, obviously call us out. We're fine with it.
But I want to throw something out to you to start the show.
Okay.
You are the political guru here. Christian Horner made some comments. These comments were a few weeks ago. They seem to be getting more play now, maybe to drum up some clicks and drum up some excitement, maybe. I don't know. Or not excitement, but divisiveness. I saw it today, the quote from Christian Horner to the New York Post. I'm assuming these comments were made during the Red Bull launch a few weeks back. So Christian said, F1 is not a political sport, which I almost immediately laughed and spit out my coffee. He said, and it shouldn't be used politically. We're a sport. We're a form of entertainment and a form of escapism from some of the shit going on in the world. I'm going to stop right there, and I'm just going to let you talk.
Take a big, long breath. I feel like I have so many just different ideas of how I want to respond to that brewing. For those new to the show, I was a government major, and I feel like, knowing what I know about how life operates in other parts of the world, knowing that as a journalist, I read the comments and I always see what people are saying about F1 in particular, because it is the most globally recognized sport next to baseball, next to soccer. Even soccer isn't as popular in the US as baseball is around the world. But I think for Christian Horner to make that comment, I think it just shows how naive he is to the reality of how much politics in F1 and government in F1 are involved with each other. And there is a huge difference, for those who don't know, between government and politics. Government, obviously, is legislation, things that happen at the legislative level. Politics are typically the conversations that influence those backroom decisions that typically are included in bills and things like that are passed at that legislative level. And this is common all around the world. So for Christian to say that F1 is not a political sport, we all know politics and those backroom conversations are what drive the regulatory aspects of the FIA, which obviously regulates Formula One. So you can't avoid that F1 is intrinsically political. And yes, it is a form of entertainment and a form of escapism from some of the shit that's going on in the world. But you also can't avoid the shit that's going on in the world as it relates to Formula One. You look at what happened last year at the Aramco bombing, and how that affected the athletes. And for the first time, athletes were really, I think, regarded for their political opinions. And that incident kind of changed, I think, how people view athletes or F1 drivers and politics and their opinion about politics. And for the FIA to say that we're going to ban political statements, et cetera, you understand that that's coming from, and that's an economic driver. That is motivated by money and money alone. They're trying to maximize their profits, and you can't maximize your profits when you're having a bunch of athletes that are saying things that contradict the culture of some of the countries that they're racing in. And so for Christian Horner to say that, I think I truly don't believe he thinks that. I think that Horner just wants people to focus on racing. Which, again, I also understand we all want to focus on racing, but we also get that with a lot of the political and governmental issues that are happening in a lot of these race countries, you can't avoid that. We don't live under rocks anymore. We live in the time of Twitter, of real-time information, of people acting as news analysts without a journalism degree. You don't need to have a license to practice journalism. You just have to be there and understand, and be able to provide the information in a really contextual way. And people are able to do that. I think as a culture, as a society, as a world, we are emotionally intelligent enough to handle that. So, yeah, I do think it's shocking that he would say something like that, because we all know the truth about F1. we all know the truth about racing and global events and politics and government and all those things. But like I said, I think that's his way of, let's get back to racing. And I can't fault the guy, because we do turn to sport to get away from politics and government and the heaviness of the world. But we also can't avoid it being that F1 is the most globalist sport in history.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that the only sport more political than Formula One is soccer, football, UEFA, FIFA. There's so many scandals and political, you know, political ties with that. In fact, many believe, and I think it's probably very accurate, that FIFA has so much power in the world that they actually move or influence, you know, things like elections and whatnot in some, you know, smaller or less developed countries. But Formula One is got to be right there behind it. And when I sent you the when I sent you the screen grab, your first response to me, your initial response to me was, someone paid him. And I was just, I was dying. It was so funny.
That's my initial response to lots of things. Like when Fernando said that Lance Stroll was the future F1 champion. And it's like, okay, Fernando, blink twice if you're okay. Like, who paid you? I say that to a lot of things that I'm kind of like, kind of questioning. But 99% of the time, it's a joke. This time, this was not a joke.
It's so hard to like want to believe anything that's said anymore by anybody, especially in a position where they are directly impacted by the repercussions of their words, right? Or their words have repercussions is what I should have said. And Christian is right there. I mean, he's got a driver who is arguably the most buttoned up, I would say, or one of the more buttoned up drivers, doesn't really want to get involved in the political statements, and he doesn't really, you know, Max doesn't really care too much about anything but racing, which is how he was really raised by his dad, right? Focus on racing. It's all about racing. It's all about racing, which is why I think him and Christian work very well together. Although Christian loves talking. So I just thought it was funny, and I think for our listeners that are like, I didn't know about that story. F1 not being a political sport is really hysterical. And listen, something being political, I guess I want to clarify my thought process on this, is that just because something's, that doesn't mean it's bad. Like, yeah. I think we use the word political to, as a negative sometimes, like it's political. It's fine. I mean, the sport itself, the FIA, they make decisions on what countries get races, knowing that countries that get races have direct economic impact. I mean, it is what it is, right? Like, we're not saying something negative. We are saying that the sport has the power to influence things politically, period.
Yeah.
Drivers not being able to come out and make statements. There was a huge uproar over that as well. In fact, Christian also said, we don't want robots. That was his comment against that, which is why it was kind of weird that he came back and made this comment, because it was like, you were on the driver's side with them making political statements or them making social statements, and now you're saying this. So that was kind of weird, because I'm like, dude, you literally were one of the first people to say, like, we don't want robots and we want to let our drivers, you know, say what they want and believe. And anyway,
yeah,
just very funny. Being political is not a negative thing, I don't think. It is.
And that's also, people need to understand that political doesn't necessarily mean Congress or Parliament. And I think that's why people have such a bad, reaction to that word. That's what they're used to hearing that word in context with. And you have to, again, you have to remember, every single thing in life is political. In your own businesses, things are done that are out of political motivation. thing that you work in, anything that you're trying to accomplish, we all have a little bit of leverage in something, and we're trying to exercise that. I think it's more of a psychological condition more than anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think that when it comes to Red Bull, we all know that Horner, he's a shit starter. That's what he likes to do. He likes to be in the news. He likes to ruffle feathers. He likes to give you a storyline, and he loves playing the villain, and he's so good at it. So
yeah. Again, that's another definition of the word, right? Like
exactly.
I think this is a question that someone, actually, I believe it was maybe your brother, had asked you, right?
Yes.
And so he I don't remember the full context of the comment or the question, but you and I kind of talked about this a little bit and thought of, you know, could esports be something that changes that dynamic in Formula One, right? Where, and maybe nepotism is not the right word, right? It's, yes, we see nepotism itself across racing series, maybe in the junior levels and coming up into Formula One, giving opportunity to certain ones over others, but also just the fact that it is very much a sport where those that have are given more opportunity simply because they can afford to have that opportunity, whereas maybe the most talented are not always the ones that naturally are able to rise to the top, are given the opportunity to rise to the top. So one of the things we were discussing was, can esports drivers, or can esports change that? And a perfect example was the Race of Champions, the one that just took place in January in Finland, or Sweden. So Team Finland, round one, we had Team Finland, Valtteri Bottas, a very experienced Formula One driver, Mika Hakkinen, a Formula One champion, lost in the first round to Team Irak of Lucas Blakely, who I believe drives for McLaren Esports, and Jarno Otmir, who I believe drives for Mercedes Esports.
I think Mercedes.
I think he also drives in the Formula E Esports as well for Mercedes. But they beat him, which was kind of, it's kind of funny, right? Like, you've got two incredible Formula One drivers, and then you've got, now Jarno has experience on the track. He raced in Formula 4, I want to say F2. So he's got some experience. But Lucas, as far as I know, and I'm not a big esports person, so like, I don't know all the details. I believe Lucas doesn't. So they're, you know, given this opportunity to go against Formula One legends, or a, you know, at least one legend, and then Valtteri Bottas, who's himself a legend, right? They beat him. That opens up for those that maybe aren't yet aware, like, oh wow, we can find talent, really good talent, in a completely different world, right? Could a kid, young kid who's been driving, you know, in esports since they were little, maybe they skipped karting, maybe they skipped, you know, lower levels of on track racing, but they're really good at esports, do those skills translate? I mean, we've seen some of the setups, and we've seen some of the, you know, the sim setups that these esport athletes have. I mean, they're like real cockpits. Like, even Max Verstappen has, you know, he has one, and it's a way for him to practice away from, I mean, it's not, he may not be looking at it as practice because he drives a real F1 car, but it's a way for him to also keep his mind sharp, right? The hand-eye coordination, negotiating turns, corners. You're still driving the real tracks that you're racing on. So it's an opportunity, right? Maybe it's not the best sim compared to an F1 car, but it's maybe a step below that, right? And I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars poured into this. So you've got to think that at some point, there's more opportunity for esport athletes to, if they wanted to, of course, go into that next level or go into, make a lateral move, I'll say, into, you know, real racing or real, real life racing. I don't know how else to put it, and I feel bad saying it because I don't, I'm not trying to take away from esports. I'm an old dude that, wasn't an esports person. So anyway, I think there is a lot of opportunity there, and I don't want to keep rambling. I'd love to hear your thought.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking the same thing. Could esports drivers infiltrate the feeder structure? I don't know that we've pushed the needle enough, or that if the esports drivers have pushed the needle enough. You've already got issues with guys like Colton Herta trying to get into F1. So when it comes to those actual super licenses, how do you acquire super license points in a simulator? Essentially, you don't. So, it could provide maybe some opportunities for some on-track testing, but again, earning those 40 super license points to be able to race in F1 or earning super license points in lower parts of that feeder structure, if that is the end game to actually race in F1, that's going to take a lot of time. That's going to take a lot of time away from your craps and what you're good at. And I think this is why it's important that teams, I think, are starting to associate themselves with these esports drivers, is because it also gives them another, I think, form of marketing. It gives them another just thing to do, perhaps. And that is that they can attach their name to. That's something that's trending, that's modern, that's fresh, that's sort of an interesting take on racing. But I will say that these drivers, they're building quite the reputations and marketing opportunities for themselves. Admittedly, I don't follow esports the way a lot of other people do. It's just, I think video games have never really been my thing to begin with, but I understand it and I respect what they're doing. But I think that the benefits to esports, I mean, there are a lot of them. You don't have to pay massive entry fees, and prize pools are definitely starting to inch up to make it where it's pretty lucrative for these drivers. So again, if the goal is for you to get into an actual car, knowing that there's a lot of money to be made on the esports side, why would you try and race knowing that the barriers to entry to F1 are extremely high, and you're also competing against drivers who have been in karting, who've been through the feeder system, essentially, who have a lot of backing from other people because they know that they're proven on track. So why would you want to compete with that unless you know you're really, really freaking good and you just really kind of want to take that leap? And I'm sure we'll see it eventually. But I think these drivers are creating something within esports, and it makes sense for them to kind of stay there. And I hate saying that because you always want to be like, push the glass ceilings and, you know, and see what you can do. But I just, again, I see so many people, the fact that you have IndyCar drivers who are saying that the super license structure prevents them or prohibits them really from entering F1, that makes it almost impossible for esports drivers to get there too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get into the super license aspect of the conversation in a second. I wanted to kind of close close a loop on the question that was asked, or part of the question that was asked, and it was a follow-up it was your brother.
Yeah.
Made was, are some F1 drivers only good at F1 style racing? And this is actually a conversation that I've seen a lot lately, especially online, of people saying, somebody actually wrote an article that said, can you be the GOAT without being a Formula One driver? I don't know if you saw that.
I
did you see? So it was basically the thought that exactly what we're talking about, really. There's so many other types of racing that like is the only way to be the greatest driver of all time is if you're in Formula One. You know, NASCAR has its champions, IndyCar has its champions. You've got, you know, different, you've got all the endurance champions. You know, when you talk about iconic races, two of the three are not Formula One, right? One is IndyCar, and one is Le Mans, right? Le Mans, IndyCar, Monaco Grand Prix. Like, those are, when you talk about three iconic races, and is Formula One the only way to define yourself as great? And I mean, I don't believe so. And if we go back to Race of Champions, there was more F1 versus, you know, somebody else. First of all, F1 drivers didn't even win the Race of Champions. Travis Pastrana beat Drugovic, who's now racing in, right, at least he's a reserve in Formula One. Blakely and Otmir, they lost by a hair to Sebastian Vettel and Mick Schumacher in their races, which were not in Formula One cars or anything. They were in those Polaris. It was like, kind of like dune buggies. I'm not exactly sure what they are, but they raced in those. So I was like, okay, you know, you look at things like that, that kind of level the playing field for others. You start to think that there are, you know, there's definitely other opportunities for others to be great or have the opportunity to be in that conversation. But the question itself is posed in a way of like, are drivers, F1 drivers, good at other style racing? Here's the thing. These guys are adrenaline junkies, most of them, right? They can be very good at a lot of other things if they want to, if they put the time and effort in. And I think this is part of the question, right? If you really wanted to go and be good at NASCAR and you are, you know, Lewis Hamilton, maybe, I don't know, I'm going to say maybe not at his age, but, you know, Jimmy Johnson is older than Lewis Hamilton, and Jimmy Johnson still, you know, maybe he's not dominating the way he used to, but he's still able to have an impact. And you know, Jimmy Johnson will also be racing in Le Mans with Jenson Button and Mike Rockenfeller under the Garage 56 entry. There's kind of like a different thing. You know, Jenson Button's going to go into a NASCAR and race in Le Mans. Kimi Raikkonen came and raced in NASCAR last year, and I believe Team Trackhouse is going. Justin Marks, the owner of that team, is working on a deal with Kimi to keep him coming back or to be an entry in NASCAR in that on that team. So there's definitely other, and there's, listen, the list goes on. Like, we could name so many others. You know, Fernando Alonso raced in, I mean, I'm not very well in IndyCar, but I mean, there's other opportunities, right? If they wanted to go and take them, they would have to put in their time, just like they did in Formula One, to build their craft and perfect it. So do I think they can be good elsewhere? Absolutely. Just like I think a NASCAR driver, given the right amount of time, could race in, you know, Formula One or race in IndyCar or, you know, in endurance racing. Like, you can if you work at it. If these guys are built and wired to be okay with driving fast, you know, dangerous situations, it's just different. So and there's been a lot of this conversation lately. I've noticed even on like TikTok, where F1 fans will say things like, oh, NASCAR sucks, NASCAR drivers suck, Formula One driver would totally destroy a NASCAR driver at whatever X. And it's like, yeah, well, sure, if you level the playing field, or if you don't level the playing field, right, and you give the F1 driver an F1 car, of course he's going to be the NASCAR driver, because they're not used to driving that. And that's why, well, we'll just kind of full circle this, but that's why we go back to things like Race of Champions, where it levels the playing field to an extent. It's almost more fun to watch that kind of stuff, right? It's like, oh, I just want to see these guys. I just want to see their skill, their raw skill at play. And I think they're all very talented. I think all of these race car drivers are very talented. Doesn't matter what series you race in, you've got to have guts, focus. You gotta be able to block out a lot of noise. And those things translate across the board into other racing series or other pursuits.
I think one of the biggest reasons that why F1 is that sort of global comparison, though, is because it is the highest level in the FIA in terms of single seater. And that's always what people want to compare it to, because they just think this is the best league essentially in the world. And that's not an unfair thing to say, but, you know, it's just, I think as F1 continues to grow and turn and continues to earn that global recognition, these are just, I think, those comparisons that drivers are just going to have to be getting used to. I mean, they've been used to them for a long time. It's interesting when you have people from other countries who say things like, I don't understand why Super Bowl winners call themselves world champs. You don't compete anywhere around the world. You compete in the United States. Only how can you call yourselves world champions? And it's like, okay, I can see that. But there are athletes from other countries on NFL rosters. The NFL does play in, you know, in its international series in Mexico, in the UK, I think Germany. But yeah, I get what they're saying. They're not exactly competing as a German team or a Mexican team or a British team. We all know, we know who would win in any of those game scenarios. But they are the best in the world and they know that. And if you are a great football player, American football player, you're from another country, you're going to do everything in your power to get a scholarship to a D1 college in the US so that you can go to college here and hopefully try and make it into the NFL, knowing that there's a very slim margin that you'll even make it to a practice squad, no less. So it is incredibly, So I think that's why that F1 will always and continue to be that sort of benchmark for what it means to be the best driver in the world. So regardless of whether you're NASCAR or F1, I mean.
And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that answer. I think I'm okay with that being accurate. You know, Formula One is challenging, grueling. It is, but maybe not as much, you know, as it was 30 or 40 years ago, right? The cars are different. I don't want to say the cars drive themselves because I don't believe that either. There's so many folks that, you know, say, oh, well, you know, Lewis had a great car, so he didn't have to do anything. It's like, no, okay, that's not true. But I do think the cars are a lot different. And I can't remember if it was Sebastian Vettel that made this comment, but it was like, if you put a driver from today into a car in, you know, 70s or 80s F1 car, you know, it's vastly different. Especially if they've never driven one of those before. And a lot of these guys do get the opportunity to drive these cars and whatnot, but let's just say they've never have. It's like a completely brand new, you know, thing you're doing. It's totally different. But if you were to take a driver from 70s and 80s and throw them into a new car, it's the same thing. Because now they're like, it's not the same thing, I'm sorry. It's just as difficult for them to adapt, right? Because now there's electronics and computers and all these buttons on the steering wheel and you're not shifting. There's not like an actual shifter anymore. You know, like there's no, it's different, right? Yeah. So times changed. And I don't even know where I was going with this point, but that was my point. I'm just going to drop it right there.
But at the same time though, we're the video game generation where we grew up knowing how to do things with our thumbs. You know, and so why would F1, the evolution of F1, not mirror that? I think it'd be pretty weird if you had a bunch of kids from a bunch of millennials and the next generation kids who grew up playing video games suddenly having to drive these bulky steering wheels. I mean, with an actual clutch, like that would be strange. But
I don't know. That's real racing, or to me that's a real car. But that's a whole different episode.
Yeah, do you think that Lando, for example, or Charles, who, I mean, I think they got a lot more people involved in F1 just by playing video games on their Sims during COVID, when everything shut down, it's like everybody was like, oh, what are the race cars doing? What are the drivers doing? And, you know, people were watching that. So them growing up with that, I mean, yeah, I'm sure that they look at pure racing and say, okay, yeah, a steering wheel and a clutch, that is pure racing. But at the same time, would they be as effective as drivers if what they did in their day-to-day, driving their cars, playing their video games, being on their iPhones, didn't somewhat have that muscle memory that mimicked driving an F1 car now? If they had to switch from a completely different type of use of their hand-eye coordination, et cetera, would the driving be as good?
No, of course not. I think, well, if they were, again, it goes back to if they were, you know, started and that's how they raced and the whole entire time, you know, everything they were doing and practicing was with that type of equipment all the way up. Even the simulator type stuff was that, then it's a different story, because I truly do believe that these folks, you know, men or women or people that are driving race cars, you need that mental ability, right? Other than that, you can train them on anything else, whether it's driving with a clutch or maybe it's shifting on the steering wheel or pushing buttons on the steering wheel. You could learn all of that because they're at such a higher level mentally. I that's what I think, you know, like that's how I feel about their mental, like they're at such a different level that you could train them to do other things. It's like baseball players, right? Their hand-eye coordination is so much better than the average human being. Because they're getting a ball thrown at them at 100 miles an hour from 60 feet away, 60 feet, 6 inches away. Go and put yourself into a batting cage. For any of the Europeans listening that don't know what a batting cage is, it's basically a cage with an automated machine that throws a ball at you for you to swing and try to hit it. And go put yourself into a batting cage with the 90 plus mile an hour speeds and see if you can even swing the bat fast enough. Like your eyes literally can't even make, for a lot of people, right? For probably 95% of people. Like that takes a lot of, that skill there alone is what sets apart a lot of, you know, we're talking about baseball for a second, right? So I believe that, yes, in Formula One, it's the same thing. Like, they have something else that the average person doesn't. The other things they may have to adapt to, if we're talking about, like, technology versus, you know, older cars or older technology, I think that anyone can learn, you know, they can learn that. They can figure it out. Let's put it this way. If you or I could figure it out, which we could, how much better can they do it, right? I could figure it out and it won't do anything because I'm just not good enough, period, right, to drive an F1 car. But they could figure it out and then continue to hone that craft or hone that over and over and over. Never mind they can put the time into that. Like, you and I don't have the time to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, but yes, to your point, the racing would not be as good. Evolution is good, and evolution is good.
We love evolution here on the VF1 show. Big fans of it.
Big fans.
Huge fans. I just look at the steering wheel. I think of a video game, and so I think when you're especially a young guy, you're a driver, even a young girl, and you see that, and you're like, hell yeah, that looks so cool. Petrolhead purists would absolutely disagree with me. That's okay. But again, that's where racing is at right now. So to your point, I think you're right. If they condition them well enough, they would be able to drive those cars. And I think that they're world-class drivers. They would absolutely be able to drive those cars. They have driven those cars in a lot of cases. But again, I think that everything is so automatic. Everything just switches in their head. It's so automatic. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Every steering wheel is set up according to the driver and their preferences and how they like it. No one F1 steering wheel is going to be the exact same. So everything is different. And that's what they're used to. So I think you take that away from them, they're going to be like, yay, this is really cool. They're going to be excited about it. But then they're going to be like, okay, how do I do this? You know, mm-hmm. forget. And you know, so I like where we're at right now with the technology. I think it's exciting. And I like that, back to evolution, being big fans of it, I like that it's growing with the technology that I think these athletes are growing with, especially in their personal lives with video games.
Yeah.
It makes it easier.
For sure. I'm with you. I will, as much of a V10 guy I am, I will agree with you. I think it's still enjoyable.
That is
still enjoyable to watch.
Sound.
Yeah, I know. Well,
God, I miss that sound. Oh.
I don't think we're getting that back.
But you know what upsets me? And we talked about this over the week. There's that commercial of Max Verstappen. It's the Ford, after the Ford launch, where he is FaceTiming Christian. He's like, hey, you said I'm supposed to be looking for a van. And he's FaceTiming him and says this van behind him. And he's like, no, not that van, that van. And it shows this electric van, and it's Max driving it, and it's an electric van, obviously. I text you and I was like, this sound drives me crazy.
It was cool as shit though. That was
cool. Yeah, but the sound, it was like, ooh.
No, the sound is terrible. I agree.
So how did they get around that? Like that
sound?
Yeah, like I've heard people saying that if F1 goes electric in the next maybe 10, 15 years, that they would have to find some way to mimic that sound or nobody would show up. And I'm like, then stop trying to.
So Stefano Domenicali came out and said Formula One will never go electric. Just came out and said that a couple days ago.
Good.
He said Formula One will never go electric. They're going to continue creating sustainable ways to use internal combustion engines or, you know, hybrid engines.
Okay.
And I respect that. I can respect that. I just, you know, I don't think they sound great, but it's okay. I'm trying to let that go. I still have all the old footage and whatnot that I can go listen to. But no, I don't think you could go and mimic. I think if you went and faked that, it would feel even worse. Like it would just, it's like those, you know, where people, they mimic in their electric cars, or I think Tesla even has this option where you can like make it sound like a real engine, and it like comes out of the speakers or something. That's just like, that's stupid. To me, that's making a mockery of us, the consumers.
I walked by a Tesla in the parking lot the other night. I literally said out loud, that car sounds so stupid. I was walking from my car.
Doesn't sound like anything. Doesn't sound like anything.
I don't know if that person had their window up. I'm not sure, it was at night, but walking by, I'm like,
yeah,
stupid. And legit, there. I hate the sound of electric cars. I'm like, stop it. I mean, I understand the concept. I get the concept. I think it has a good intention, minus the whole electric battery components, et cetera, et cetera. Those aren't very, you know, eco-friendly or human-friendly, if you know what I mean. But I just, they're not for me. Just not for me.
Listen, I'm on board with technology. I think it's cool. I think it's wonderful. But like you said, it's not for, like, I'm not into it.
If my car doesn't make a legitimately sexy sound when I start it, I don't want it. Just flat out, I'd rather walk. I mean,
I don't disagree. So we're on the same page. We don't have to keep beating that one.
Well, speaking of, exactly. Well, speaking of walking, super late.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's a lot to unpack here.
Where do we want to go with this? Because it's interesting. I think it's fascinating.
Obviously, drivers, they need valid super license to compete in F1. And it's the hardest license to get. So let's just start
very difficult.
With that. Drivers, they've got to be, 18 by their first
18.
Competition. They have to have a competition license, an international competition license, and a commercial license. They have to pass a test.
Yep.
And then what's
theory?
Yeah, theory test. And then they have to complete two seasons.
It's like 80%, two full seasons.
Yeah.
In single seater championships. And then they have to have accumulated 40 points over the previous three seasons.
Yeah.
In any combination of the championships reported in Supplement 1 of the regulations. That's actually, I just pulled it up. So you have a whole slew of championships that you can earn points in that earn you 40 points. If you win the FIA Formula 2 championship or come in second or third, you get 40 points. So that gives you enough points, granted, you know, that you have all of the other, you meet all the other qualifications as well. This is where I think things get funny. If you win IndyCar, you get 40 points. But if you come in second or third in IndyCar, you don't get enough points for your super license. You only get 30 points for second, 20 points for third. So essentially the FIA says, hey, the Formula 2 championship ranks higher than IndyCar.
Yeah.
At the FIA Formula 3 championship, the FIA Formula E championship, and the World Endurance Championship, the Hypercar, those all get 30 points for first place, which puts them on par with Indy's second place or the F2's fourth place. And then it keeps going down. There's different regional championships from, you know, Middle East, Asian, Americas, Japanese, all of those, Formula Renault, all of those are much lower. They don't have enough points if you win those. W Series, NASCAR Cup Series actually gets 15 points towards the super license if you win NASCAR, but that is not even anywhere close to the amount of points. So if you were to have won NASCAR, you would have to win NASCAR 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
I think three.
Well, it's 15
winning. Points if you win first.
15, 30, 45. Yeah. So even if
45 points.
Win that though, you're staying in NASCAR. Why would you want to go to compete in?
Yeah, no, of course.
Highest level.
Yeah. It's when you look at the chart, it's interesting because it kind of gives you an idea of, and I know this is not exactly where we wanted to go, but it just gives you an idea of what the FIA says, like what we think is more valuable than another, right? What series we place more value on that can race in Formula One. So, I encourage you, the listener, if you do get a chance, look it up and go check out the chart and see what you find, you know, ironic or what you find funny on the chart. Because I think it's comical that the way the points are given out. Hey, listen, we know it's a money thing. We'll get into that in a second. So we know it's about dollars. We know it's about keeping F1 exclusive. Not giving any, you know, listen, there's 20 drivers in any given year. And that's it. 20. You know, name me another sport, and I'm sure somebody will have an answer to this, but I'm going to say this. You know, name another series or sport that has so little opportunities for someone to get into, you know, and then of course, as you age, as you run out of opportunities with, you know, sponsors and whatnot, you can quickly lose your chance to race. You know, there was talk of Yuki and Zhou Guanyu already, you know, not having or potentially losing their seats, right? And I was like, they just got here. But because they may not have, you know, their sponsors, or they may not have, or you know, someone else might have something that's more attractive to a team, well, they'll lose their spot. And it's like, man, when you think about that and how cutthroat it is, it's like, imagine going through what they have to go through to get just enough points to even race in the series, right?
Yeah.
And then not even really be guaranteed any longevity in that. for any, you know, amount of time. Obviously, if you're successful, and someone's going to tell me, well, if you're successful, of course you're going to stay. But it's like, okay, but in every sport, you always have the top of the top, cream of the crop. You always have your kind of middle of the pack, and then you have obviously the folks at the bottom, which that's fine. The folks, the ones at the bottom that can't cut it, fine. They should be out of, you know, out of the sport or go find a different league to play in. But in Formula One, it's like these guys, even to be the last place drivers, have to go through so much. I know we want to talk about how much drivers have to pay each year. And I don't know if this was because of my thread that I put out this week, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah. I saw that Max Verstappen quote, and I just thought it was, I mean, he said it, I think it's absurd when asking him. I mean, he has to pay $1.2 million USD to the FIA for his historic 454 points scored in 2022. So, yeah, when we talk about the barriers to entry in Formula One, you know, we talk about how some drivers, they could have their entry fees or their super license fees paid for by their teams. But, you know, there's drivers who have to pay their own super license fees. And I just, yeah, you talk about the Yuki Tsunoda, Zhou Guanyu thing and how they, because of sponsors, because of interest, because of all sorts of different variables, they might be out of a seat if they're not performing the way they're expected to. And when you also think about the actual fees, if you're not making as much money as the other drivers for whatever reason, when you get that pool, because chances are if you're on sort of the lower, the backside of F1, chances are you're not going to have that written into your contract. Chances are that's something that's performance-based where the team says, if you score X amount of points, or if you finish here in the driver's championship, or we finish here in the constructors, then we'll pay this fee for you. So, I mean, there's a lot we don't know about that. So we're just kind of, you know, making assumptions here. But you have to assume that that would be performance-based. And if you're not performing, obviously your fee is going to be significantly lower, but you're still going to have to pay that regardless. And so if you are one of those drivers that's just trying to break into F1 and you're looking at all the other fees associated with it, you're looking at trying to get as many sponsors as humanly possible so that you look attractive to these teams, because let's call it what it is. It's a money grab. These teams want guys that can also bring in the money, who can also bring in the sponsors. So, you know, the money should not be an issue for drivers. That should be the last thing they're having to be concerned with. They should be focused on the driving. But because everything is about money in Formula One, that becomes an issue for drivers. And as the season progresses, you have to imagine that we talked about this last week, that some sponsors that were here on day one might not be here 6 months from now. And it's important for drivers to be as attractive as possible to bring in that money. So there's a lot of responsibility, financial responsibility on these drivers to keep their seats. And that's why I think super licenses and that fee that goes directly to the FIA, it is absurd. That is a lot of freaking money. That is, we're talking base fee for the super license is $11,169 plus $2,255 per point.
Well, and for reference, that number was 10,000 euro or $12,800, I believe, in 2012. And it was 1,000 euro, so whatever the conversion that is in 2012 per point. It's now 2,100 per point.
Yeah.
So that's double, right? Last season, Max, Charles, Sergio, George, Carlos, and Lewis all paid over 500,000 euro. I have the euro number in front of me. I don't have the dollars number in front of me. Sorry. Now, Max has got paid by his team, right? Max complained, and I think Dr. Marco came out and was like, well, we have to pay it anyway, so don't, you know, it's not like he has to worry about it, which kind of comical anyway. But, you know, it is quite outrageous, right? So it's, you have more success, you owe more. I am not going to get into the politics of that, but it is a lot like taxes, right? To an extent. Here's the thing. The FIA also collects money from the teams. So there's a flat rate per team. So just like the super license, that there's a flat fee, there's a flat rate of $617,000+ for a team, in addition to $7,400 per point for a team. So Red Bull paid an additional $6.2-ish million for their championship. And then for whatever reason, again, random, non-champions had to pay $6,100 per point. So about $1,300 less per point than the champions Red Bull. They collected just for the Formula One season to like kick off and the FIA to say, here's our blessing to race kind of thing. $26 million. To do really just, and listen, I get it to an extent. That's how the FIA gets funded. This is where most of their money comes from, you know, super licenses. But that's a lot. That is a ton. You could really see why there's a lot of animosity between F1, Formula One management, Liberty Media, and the FIA at times. That stuff really. It's got to be a consideration, I would think, where it's like, hey, we're literally funding you. Like, leave us the F alone, right? Or let us be. Like, we're already paying you all of this money. Like, just leave it alone. And they've gone back and forth. Go ahead.
That's why the bureaucracy at all is so laughable. When you think about how much additional money the FIA is going to make just by adding races, adding points to the races. I think Max noted somewhere that the races, additional races meant another, I think, almost $500,000 in earnings for the FIA. So it's like the more successful F1 is, the more successful those drivers are, the more they have to pay for the ability to compete. And yet then the FIA is going to continue and say, oh, in the name of safety and regulations, we're going to continue demanding this, 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 and this. We're going to continue making the barriers to entry into F1 damn near impossible when it comes to the super licenses. And, oh, but we're doing all of this in an effort to protect Formula One from itself, because it's had such incredible growth that, oh, well, somebody has to act as the governing body. And well, by definition, that's us. So that's how they justify it. I'm pretty sure that's how they justify it, at least. And are they right or are they wrong? Who knows? But I think that in terms of, yeah, that bureaucracy, that taking advantage of the situation, they know exactly what they're doing. And I think, I wonder if there's going to be a potential strike, maybe, or some action is going to be taken by these drivers at some point, because you're adding these extra races, you're making drivers pay more money, you're not really doing a whole lot to, I think, help the sport. Liberty Media is doing all that. So yeah. What exactly is the FIA doing to enrich Formula One right now? And I think that that is why, when it comes to the commercial interests of the sport, Liberty Media has every right to continue calling out the FIA for exactly what it is. I mean, at this point, it's just kind of siphoning money off the top. It's not really doing much for the sport at all.
Well, I mean,
it's being there.
You know, they've been a nonprofit for, I don't know, 120 years, 118 years, whatever it might be. They've been around since 1904, so whatever the math is, 119 years. So with that, one would think there's something else they do, but really they really are just there to set regulations, right? That's the argument for those that are FIA supporters. It's like, hey, this is all they're here for. They're just here to regulate. Like, that's the reason for their existence. I don't have a number on salary and how much they've, you know, paid, they pay out in salaries. I'd be curious to see that number. If somebody listening has some up-to-date information there, I'd love to hear what that is. But that's got to be the majority of what they're doing, right? Because it's not like they're not promoting. They're not really, I don't want to say they're doing nothing, because that would diminish a lot of hardworking people's jobs. But they're not promoting these events. So where is it? You know, and this is totally just putting this question out there, not something that needs to be answered, but where does the line get drawn? Kind of like what you said. At what point do you see a Formula One who is providing most of, if not all of your funding, where do they say, you know what, we don't need you anymore? You know, is that something that could happen? I don't know. I have no idea. I'm, again, putting that out there. I'd love to generate some conversation around that amongst folks that are listening. Like, is there a point where the two could exist without one another? I don't know if the FIA could. I think Formula One absolutely could.
If NASCAR can exist without the FIA, then...
Well, NASCAR and IndyCar do, because NASCAR, those aren't FIA...
Exactly.
Yeah, no, 100%, 100%.
F1 could absolutely exist without the FIA. People just kind of have that automatic assumption, and maybe are new to motorsports, that the FIA is the governing body for absolutely every single motorsport in the world, and it's not.
There's no indication that that's not the case, right? Like, there is, when you have team principals, drivers, the FIA president coming out and speaking totally against what the FIA has, you know, put out there and said, and this is not necessarily new either, right? This has been like this. Again, we go back to the politics of the business itself. You've got to think that's not a good sign, right? Especially with the growth trajectory that F1 is on, and the level that they want to bring it to, the, you know, how global, maybe to a degree less exclusive. I don't know if that's actually the case. I'd love to know that. I would love to talk to somebody directly at F1 and know what the plan is. But the marketing says that that's how they're operating. The marketing is telling me that you want to be more inclusive, more diverse, more sustainable. You don't want the series to be as exclusive as it has been in the, you know, up until now. So that's got to come to a head, I would think.
Yeah, I think that the FIA should serve to mitigate potential issues between, say, Middle Eastern activities, political events, things that are happening there, and then how F1 could deal with that stuff. We talk about the politics, the government, you know, is what I'm referring to, the government side of what's happening in these countries. I think mitigation should be where the FIA really has that utility within F1 And I think they're trying to do that by eliminating those political statements. But that doesn't really do much for Liberty Media. That basically says this is the most low effort thing you could do possible to try and mitigate something. Like, let's try and get ahead of this. Let's be preemptive rather than reactive. And I think that is something that I think the FIA and F1 really have always kind of fallen short. And I don't know. I think that political statement ban, that was extremely low effort on the FIA's part in terms of mitigating controversies and issues between especially drivers and Middle Eastern countries. And if that's the best that they can do, then certainly someone at Formula One, certainly someone at Liberty Media can do a lot better than that. And they know it too. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I would really like to hear other people's opinions. So if you are a fan of the show, if you are somebody with an F1 and you maybe have some insight, let us know. We'd love to have a chat about this off record, on record.
Yeah, and I think it's only going to get, it's going to grow its influence. And not to get too deep into the sponsorship aspect, but I think the more that brands see the value in Formula One and the more money that flows into and around the sport or the series, I should say, that's how you kind of grease the wheels, right? That's how you get things to happen. That's how you make things work, right? When you've got money flowing in, you can't deny or argue with certain aspects of it. And brands and sponsors are going to want to see their dollars grow. And if the FIA is a hindrance to that, to any extent, however that might be, they'll be in for quite the battle.
Yeah.
I want to move away from this topic. I want to get into a little more fun here in the last section of the show. Testing.
Yeah.
F1 testing. So you're listening to this. We've already had a day of testing yesterday. Yesterday being Thursday. We've got testing happening now. What is testing, though? A lot of people have been asking, you know, what exactly does testing seek to accomplish? As a fan, as a new fan of the sport, what am I getting out of this, right? Because most people have zero clue. They're just like, I want to watch the races, and there's a winner, and there's a podium, and there's a fun song, and a lot of champagne popping around. But with testing, you don't get that. So, like, what am I looking for, or what am I getting out of this if I'm new to the sport? I'll pass that one over to you. What are you testing? What do folks need to know about it?
Oh, man. I think testing has changed so much in the last couple of years, even that I know it's a reduced format. It's been reduced to 3 days to save costs. And the focus of testing is essentially to get all the kinks out. They want to know that things like the electrical systems, cooling, airflow, etc., they want to know that all of that is working correctly. And it is intended to sort of make sure that the data that they have collected from the shakedown, from testing, etc., aligns with the car that they essentially design in the simulators. And these car designs have been going on for a long time, which is why a lot of times you'll see team principals, etc., kind of fighting these new regulations, saying, well, we've already put so much time into our new car development. How is this going to affect the floor? How is this going to affect this? How is this going to affect that? And that is essentially because nobody likes to backtrack their plans, especially now in the cap era. So it's to make sure that the car aligns with the car that they designed and make sure that the drivers like the feel of the car. And I think this is why Lance Stroll missing testing is such a big deal for Aston Martin, because he's not really going to get the feel of that car to its full, you know, extent until the first race now. So I think they're going to be a little more behind, but also, this is why veteran drivers are so important, because they assist engineers in explaining how the cars are actually performing. So testing is integral to especially the first race, the first, I would say, real quarter of the season, because if you don't really have your kinks sorted in the first really quarter, 25% of the season, then, you know, you might as well just accept your fate. And I think that's kind of what happened with Mercedes last year. They were kind of able to focus more on the issues that were causing the car to porpoise and do, you know, perform the way it was performing, but knowing that those championships were likely out of reach. So you want to get that all kind of sorted in testing and see what works and see what doesn't.
To add to what you just said, there drivers aren't, you know, this isn't like other sports where you can go and grab a ball and go practice on the pitch with your team, right? This is, there's very limited time for drivers to get the opportunity to sit in the equipment they're driving. Yes, there's simulator time that they get, but in the actual equipment, they get very little time to be in it, to see how it handles, how it feels, which is why it's so important. Like you said, we only get 1 week of testing this year. We don't have 2 weeks like we've had in the past. And that's with, you know, trying to be more sustainable and trying to be to decrease logistics, which is great. But we only have, you know, 1 3-day testing before we get right into it. So it is very important. And if you are a fan that's watching, you may not really, if you're new and you don't, if you're not a technical person, you know, even someone like myself, I'm not one of these super technical people. I understand enough because I've heard it over a long period of time of watching, but I don't really get all of this. You'll see weird contraptions on the car, aero rakes. You'll see a lot of this paint called FlowVis paint on the cars. They're basically, you know, doing these things to see, hey, is the aerodynamics that we've designed, is that working the way we need it to work? Is it giving are we getting an advantage the way we suspect it to? But for you, a viewer, it probably means nothing, right? For the majority of people, they're going to look at that and be like, okay, cool, what is that going to tell me? Like, I don't really know what that means. And so I would highly recommend, if you are very interested in that kind of stuff, following folks on Twitter, YouTube, if you have F1 TV, you know, watching some of the more tech shows on there to get a little bit more of an in-depth, because that'll really tell you, like, okay, here's what you should have noticed, or here's what maybe you didn't notice but actually is happening. There's so many good follows on Twitter that and I'll actually tweet something out when this episode goes out with a few resources as well. So make sure you're following myself, Vincenzo Landino, or the VF Castro, because we'll tweet out some resources for you to watch and folks that you should pay attention to that can help you really get it in terms of like what you should be noticing, because really, you're just watching the cars go around. They're checking for reliability. They're checking for aerodynamics working. Is the engine working the way we want it to? Does the driver like the way the car is set up? You know, things like that. It truly is test. It is the meaning of the word testing. Well, there's, Bernie, you know, yeah. Each driver.
Oh, go on.
No, I was going to say different. You know, the drivers, they're not all on the track at once. So like, there's morning and afternoon sessions. I know that, like Max will drive all of day one, but then Sergio drives all of day three. But for the Ferrari team, it's like Carlos drives in the morning, Charles drives in the afternoon, except for day three, they swap. And a lot of teams do that. They just kind of go back and forth. So it's not like you're watching your favorite driver or anything like that, like running out there full blast, you know, all day. They swap, they're changing settings, they're coming in, they're switching, you know, in and out to test different things out. Go ahead. What were we going to add?
Yeah, I was just going to say, as a perfect example of what fans maybe should be looking for, last year, Mercedes was having a porpoising issue. Of course, there's new regulations on that. And they're saying that raising the floor to help with porpoising was supposed to have cost cars half a second per lap. So testing is where teams figure out if their designs have made that time up. And those are the things you should be looking for, because those are the storylines that you're going to be hearing people talk about. What are the issues that came up in 2022 that forced regulations, rules changes, et cetera, and how have car designs in 2023 matched those expectations or those requirements? And so I think from a fan, you know, they want to look for lap times. Like, oh, lap times, that indicates fast car, right? One would think that's not necessarily the truth. You want to know that the car is on the track. If the car is on the track, it's proving it has some reliability. If the car is spending the majority of the time in the garage, that's a bad sign. So I think that other things to look at, I mean, we know it's a secretive, testing is very secretive. We kind of, you know, you talk about the FlowVis paint that shows the aerodynamics. We can kind of see things from there. You have a lot of really technical people talking about the data and things that we necessarily wouldn't know what to pay attention to. But even talking about tires, when you tire strategy, fuel data, all that, that doesn't necessarily tell you the full story about the lap time. So it's really important to, I think, pay attention. A lot of the tech heads, if you're curious about the technology, to understand why those lap times are what they are, because they have an incredible way of breaking down this data that we just, we don't. So, I mean, these are engineers. These are people that this is what they went to school for. This is what their careers were in. This is what they're great at. So we're going to post a bunch of different people on our social media and follow those people if this is the kind of stuff that you're interested in. Because yeah, for us at face value, we look at testing and we're like, what am I looking at? Cars going around really fast. But you know, aside from that, what am I looking at? So it's, if you're really serious about F1 and you really want to know the intricacies of the sport and the technology, then this is a great time for you to just jump right in both feet and just really pay attention to stuff, because there's so many content creators that just do such a fantastic job of explaining all of this stuff.
Yeah. Things like lap times, I think, matter little.
Yeah.
So don't look at your, you know, don't look at lap times and think, oh my goodness, our team is so slow. Like, they may be running a different program that you don't know. They might be out there testing something different. They might be out there testing traction out of the corners and not just straight line speed. So it's hard to judge, right? Like you said, you have to put a lot of different pieces of data together, which is not my forte, right? That's just not me. Whereas there are folks out there that will piece all of that together. They know what programs are being run based on whatever they're seeing. They're able to take, okay, well, lap three, they ran this program. So we're going to put that lap with this lap and we'll kind of give you a combine. And they understand things a lot better. So it's fascinating to that degree. If you're someone who's very curious, there's a lot to get from this at that, you know, if you're very curious, if you are a fan that just wants to watch racing and, you know, glory, then testing is not necessarily your bag, and that's okay too. I just like testing because for me, it's, there's cars, like I said earlier, like there's cars on track. There is, we find, you know, oh, here's the other thing too. I should have said this right away and I didn't even think, but, a lot of the cars that were seen at the launches were not the real car. They're show cars. So here you're going to finally get real cars on track, obviously being driven from all the teams. So you get to finally see all these little design intricacies, what direction they're at least starting the year and going with. And again, these teams are taking this. This is what they do. They're going into this testing with a thesis, and then they're hoping that thesis is somewhat successful. And then all year, once they've obviously committed to things, now they've got the entire year to kind of keep developing and figuring out how they're going to make changes. You know, we saw Ferrari last year; they came out really hot, and they couldn't keep reliability they couldn't upgrade the way Red Bull was, or even upgrade the way that Mercedes did, and keep up with that. So testing gives you that first look at what a team is thinking, but it's only the beginning.
For what?
Yeah.
I'm excited for that. but I'm more excited, I think I will say, Drive to Survive, and only because this means that the season is here. Basically, I think Drive to Survive means the season's here. Like, download, binge watch every episode before the first race, because it's here.
Yeah. Yeah, Drive to Survive. I wasn't a Drive to Survive watcher like right away. I watched it just to get my wife into Formula One, which it worked. And so I watched along with her. So it's something we get to do together, which is fun. So that's what I'm looking forward to. But I don't know. I don't know that I have like any emotional tie to Drive to Survive the way some folks do. And there's nothing wrong with folks being emotionally tied to it, especially if it's what got you into the sport. That's awesome. But this Drive to Survive, I think, could be interesting because I know last year after Drive to Survive came out, a lot of the drivers were upset. I know Max made a comment. And now there were some social media clips of Lando making comments about radio calls that were, they stitched over totally different races where it was like, you know, they're making him look like he's got a beef with Daniel. And he's like, I didn't say that. And then they heard a radio call and his buddy was like, you said that in a different race. He's like, they're totally making this stuff up. And, you know, Max kind of said the same thing, which is why he's like, I'm not interested in talking to Drive, you know, the Netflix team, Netflix cameras as much as others are. So what I think will be interesting to watch, and this is from my production, right, background and whatnot, is will they back away from that? Because we know that the F1 did make some comments about like, hey, we need to make sure this is a little more realistic. And I wonder if they'll actually do that. My challenge is from a viewership perspective, from like, if you're Netflix, it's like, hey, we want the views. We want this thing to be number one. They can't afford for it to not be enticing or dramatic, right? But then the purists of the sport, or even the drivers and the teams and all that, they're on the other end of it and saying, you know what, we want it to be more realistic. I don't want to look like an a-hole if I'm a driver, or I don't want to look like I'm saying things that I'm not saying, or that I hate my, you know, my teammate when I don't, or, you know, whatever it might be. So I want to see if they change the direction. Saw a little shift in direction last season, slightly over the tone of the previous seasons. I'm curious to see if they continue with that trend. And it's really funny that we're having this conversation, and I'll just give you a quick shower thought that I had the other day, and I want to hear what you think. I said to myself, how long can Drive to Survive continue to be a thing, right? A lot of folks have credited it with the new awakening in the United States and Canada, you know, North America. Mario Andretti recently said that it wasn't Drive to Survive. He actually credited CODA to why Formula One is so popular in the United States. You could take that for what it's worth. But I guess my thought to you is, or my question or my statement that I'm going to make, and see how you jump on this. At some point, does Drive to Survive go away? And what is that point?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot too, because again, I maybe watch one or two episodes of Drive to Survive and then I'm kind of done with it. I'm not the biggest DTS fan, simply because I think that the fire starting, the unnecessary editing that benefits the dramatics and theatrics of the show. I've just never liked reality shows to begin with, and I really especially don't like shows where they have to take things out of context to make them more interesting. So I'm really, to your point, I hope that they figure that out this year, because I think that cheapens the show, and I think that cheapens F1 and as a whole. But it's interesting that you would ask that question, because Williams is releasing its own two-part Drive to Survive style series because it feels, you know, ignored. Let's call it what it is. It's called Untold Stories. And what I find interesting about that is that Will Buxton was the host for the Williams release, and he also has a critical role in Drive to Survive and Box to Box films. So I think it's kind of a unique situation that you would have someone who is largely the face of Drive to Survive. Everyone knows Will Buxton for, you know, he's very animated, very nice guy, very cool guy. I've had quite a few conversations with him. He's just very authentic. And so even him, the way he is portrayed in Drive to Survive, and everybody has these sort of like videos of them kind of imitating him. I know that there's that YouTuber who does a fantastic Will Buxton impersonation, where it's just, and today's news on Drive to Survive, you wonder, are they going to race cars? They take them
back. If they finish ahead of the drivers, they win.
Exactly. And so it's to see Will, who has become, I mean, he was already a character. He was already very well known in F1 before Drive to Survive came out, but he's one of the most identifiable people in F1, let's call it what it is, who's not a driver. Mm-hmm. And so for him to be the host for the Williams release and then for Williams to release its own sort of DTS trailer, I think there's a lot of energy, that's the word I'm going for right now. Energy that's sort of taking me to a place where it's like, you wonder if teams aren't going to start releasing their own behind the scenes videos or series,
of course,
because if they don't like how they're being portrayed, obviously Williams didn't like how they were being portrayed. And I think this goes back to the first couple seasons with Claire and how that just looked like a shit show. And you felt bad for Williams in that, because you're like, man, like, what a fall from grace. How sad for them, you know? And nobody liked that Williams, such a story team, such a great story of a wonderful family. Nobody liked seeing that. That sucked. And so, yeah, for Williams to do what they're doing and say, all right, if we're not going to have prominent placement on the show, we're going to take the opportunity, because we know content is king right now, and we're going to create our own content, and we're going to create our own narratives, and we're going to make our own money from this. So I wonder how many teams down the line are going to start doing this themselves. And if more teams start to jump on board with this, creating their own miniseries, creating their own, you know, unedited, it really depends on how Williams does this. If it's completely edited, where they're cutting video and making things and audio and making things look better than what they really are, we're going to know. And someone's going to talk. So I think it really depends on how Williams does this, how they execute it, how, you know, that's going to determine whether other teams do it as well. And I think if other teams decide to do this, there could be a time where you kind of have to reassess how good Drive to Survive is and how beneficial it is to the sport if other teams are essentially taking the content back and doing it themselves.
Yeah. I wrote a thread earlier this week on Twitter, and it was about the Williams series. And I mean, they literally took the Drive to Survive, like that overhead pit stop shot that Drive to Survive kind of has at the beginning of the episodes and whatnot, and they turned it into a graphic. It's called, you know, Williams Untold Story, and like, okay, that's interesting. And then the words alone, Untold Story, they're saying like, hey, no one's telling this, so we're gonna do it. I've had some conversations with some in the industry that have said, like, you know, Sky, this isn't just on Drive to Survive, but it's also, you know, Sky, the content Sky puts out, and Sky is still number one. You know, that's who a lot of these teams care about in terms of where distribution of their brand is going. According to Motorsport Broadcasting, Red Bull's Christian Horner got 33.7% of the Sky buildups. So any Sky promotional material in 22 was 33.7 of it was Christian Horner. He got more than 19 of the 20 drivers on the grid. Toto Wolff got 18%. Gunther Steiner had 7.9%. It is only right for Williams to say, you know what? There's not enough love here. We have an in-house creative team or content team that can do something just as fantastic. And we can create, we can manage our own narrative. We don't have to rely on somebody else to tell our story for us or just to tell the story of Formula One in general, right? It's like, we're going to do it our way. There's plenty of sports teams that have their own creative studios. English Premier League teams do this. La Liga teams do this. NFL teams do this. I believe NBA, there's some NBA teams that do this as well that have actually their own in-house content studios. They spend money to build their own studios to do this kind of stuff. It is only a matter of time, especially, and you think about this, if an NFL team or an NBA, not even NBA, let's stick with NFL. If NFL teams are doing this kind of stuff, why wouldn't a Formula One team do this? Or if football teams from around the world are doing this and spending money to build content studios on their grounds and within, you know, within their facilities because of the value and the importance of it, it's only a matter of time for Formula One to really dive into this if they're not already starting. There's, just think about it. Like, Formula One has, you know, you have all the sponsors, you're covered in sponsors. Like, there's so many opportunities for them to get more content sponsored, to have more revenue streams, for them to tell better stories about themselves. It's such easy content for them to create that for them not to be doing this is a gross, I think I want to call it a gross sin, but it's not really a sin. It's just a gross misrepresentation of who they are as brands. So I would love to see more of what Williams is doing versus Drive to Survive. I think the reason why Drive to Survive works is because it is that dramatic, you know, it gives you the drama, it gives you a feeling of gossip, it gives you a little bit of Real Housewives feeling for those that watched, you know, that content. So it works for what it is, but if teams don't like what they're seeing on there or they're not getting enough of what they want, it's also very easy for them to go and create it on their own. And kudos to Williams. Honestly, I'm excited to see it. There's a lot of teams that do content online, but I don't think anything to like this extent. And I could be like, I know McLaren has a YouTube series, Ferrari has one, but I don't know if it's a DTS like series or a type of series like that. I don't, that's not what they are. So it'll be interesting to see if something like that for each team actually takes off. I'm definitely going to follow it very closely. And as soon as I get any data or you know, numbers on it, I'm absolutely going to report them because I'm curious to see if it's successful.
Yeah. We think that's kind of a watch and see what happens situation. But I do think that those numbers might potentially, like I said, they might dictate whether other teams decide to do it too. And if other teams decide to do it, then other teams are essentially going to give themselves more access than they're willing to give mm-hmm. Box. Mm-hmm. And once Box starts getting boxed out of content, then what exclusive content are they going to be able to bring us that the drivers?
Yeah, and I think Box.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think Box to Box are, they are fantastic, phenomenal storytellers. Like what they've done with the different series that they've been creating on Netflix, Apple TV, and whatnot they're incredible. And they're doing exactly what they're not giving us something that they're not telling us. Like, we know what it's going to be. Like, we know Drive to Survive is going to be dramatic. We know that it's going to give us this type of like, again, that guy, like that real reality TV is the word I was looking for. We know that it's giving us that. So they're giving us exactly what they're telling us. I think there's always a space for that somewhere. Somebody wants that, but I don't know. I don't know if Drive to Survive is like, it's, you know, to think that we're in season 5 already, at some point there's going to be another iteration from Formula One, right? If they're going to want to keep growing, is it going to be something different, or do they stick with Drive to Survive? I don't know. Like, have you watched HBO, like Hard Knocks on HBO?
Well, not really. But again, I was a football analyst, so watching that kind of stuff, I was always like, meh, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if that's more of the route that they made that Formula One could go. And for those that have never seen Hard Knocks, it follows one team during their preseason, and in the NFL preseason is, I guess it was similar to testing, right? Which is, the timeline doesn't match, but, or the timelines don't match up, but Hard Knocks gives you kind of like this in-depth, I'm not gonna say in-depth, it gives you a look at how these teams operate and, you know, the things that happen behind the scenes for these NFL teams. They tend to focus on some of the lesser known players to help you, the viewer, kind of create this, kind of creates an emotional connection to some of these lesser known guys, especially the guys that might get cut from the team. Anyway, that's been going on. I don't even know how many years that's been going on. I want to say it's been some time.
A while now, yeah.
Yeah, it's over a decade. I should look it up, but I think that could be, actually, Hard Knocks has been going on since 2001, so we're literally looking at over two decades Hard Knocks has been on.
Make it stop.
That's crazy. Yeah, I mean, listen, I have watched some episodes. I'm not a diehard Hard Knocks guy. My team's also never been on it, so that's a good, and I'm happy for that, so that's a good thing. But I could see it going that direction for Formula One.
Anyway. Just say, I was saying make it stop in the sense of like make time stop, not make Hard Knocks stop, because I understand it.
Oh,
it's an important part of sports for sure. But yeah, I don't know. I think that I also want to say, it's not that I hate Drive to Survive, and I have had some people ask me what's your deal with Drive to Survive. I don't have a deal with Drive to Survive. I like the show. I think it tells a unique, or gives rather unique angles into the sport, and I think it's fantastic if you're sort of a passive F1 watcher. I mean, like I said, we're diehards. We watch it. We follow all the news. We're, you know, kind of borderline obsessed with this, and that's okay. It's a good obsession. It doesn't hurt anyone. But it's great if you're passive, or you like maybe the what's the show you were talking about, Real Housewives, but you want it more of a, you know, sports centered. It's fantastic for that if that's your thing. I just don't watch a lot of TV is what I'm trying to convey. And so it's not that I don't like Drive to Survive or Hard Knocks or any of those shows. I just don't watch TV. So I'm not really one to ask about this stuff, to be completely honest, but I have watched enough Drive to Survive to understand the concept and know what it does. I appreciate it. I appreciate what Drive to Survive or what Box to Box Films has done in terms of bringing awareness to Formula One. And I think it's absolutely responsible for at least some part of its growth. And so that's just what I want to say about that. Let's clear the air.
No, that's good. That's good. I knew where you were going with it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not trying to fight anyone here.
No fighting. All right. Well, listen, I've got nothing else.
Yeah.
Because I want to get ready to go watch testing, throw on Drive to Survive, see how they chop up the season. Yeah, that's it. Enjoy this episode. Enjoy it. I'm glad you are here listening. We would love to know, not just me. We would love to know your thoughts. Feel free to reach out to either of us on Twitter. Best place, absolute best place to reach me is Twitter, at Vincenzo Landino, and the VF Castro on Twitter. So if you have questions or comments or concerns, drop those there. We'd love to field more questions from the audience. We've been seeding a few of those in the last couple episodes, but we'd love to have a section of questions from the audience. So if you have those, let us know. Again, Twitter, best place for that. But if you want your question definitely answered on the show, go to your favorite podcast player and leave us a review. And in the review, drop a question asking us that you want on the show, and we will 100% answer it on the show. Of course, if it's appropriate, please don't be inappropriate, people.
Yes. Don't make things weird. We're here to do that enough. Y'all don't need to make it weirder with weird questions. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We will talk to y'all next week.
Later. Blah, blah.
Thank you so much for tuning into the VF1 show. If you liked it, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And for previews of next week's show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the VF Castro and Vincenzo Landino.